Hour. So welcome everyone to the bi-weekly IRSA meeting. Please follow the code of conduct and the antitrust policy. I think everybody knows this at this point. I've created a tentative agenda. Does anybody have any items they would like to add to the agenda?
Only if there's time, but I always forget the link, and then I know you sent an email to it. I just haven't looked at it.
No, no worries. Anybody else?
I'm also in the process of trying to navigate to the agenda.
I also would find it useful if there was a link to the agenda sent in the email.
Okay, I will start doing that. Yeah, it's in the same place every time, but if it makes it easier, I'd be happy to send a link to the agenda.
Hi, Hart. It's Michelle. It's my first time here, so where can I get that link? Can you maybe
post it in the chat? First of all, welcome. Thank you for joining, and thank you for introducing yourself. Yes, why don't I post that in chat then?
All right, thanks.
Yeah, it's just on the wiki. But I guess if you don't know where to look, then it's not so easy.
Good morning, all. This is James. As Maske, I've been to earlier or some meeting just to rejoin you. Thank you.
I posted it in the Zoom chat, and I'll also post it in the Rocket chat.
All right. Thank you for that.
Of course. So yes, the first thing that we had for discussion was the audit that the Indy people were interested in doing. I think Mike has alluded to the fact that they're probably interested in using a company.
Yep.
Well, maybe I can talk about that. It's actually me who started the thread on the mailing list. Basically, I was just asking myself, because I work in Montreal, Canada, mm-hmm. for a large financial institution, and also I work jointly with the government of the province of Quebec. I mean, we work together in trying to build this identity platform, and probably we are going the way of Indy, Aries, and IRSA. And so in talking about it internally, we just figured, well, we just started to ask ourselves the question, well, is this safe?
Right.
So I simply started digging and asking questions, and that's how I ended up on the mailing list for IRSA, asking those questions. So basically, I don't have any prescription. I don't have any target that needs to be met. I was just asking out of the blue, has this been audited? How can we trust this? And I understand that people here are probably some of the developers of IRSA. So it's nothing against or for you. It's just from an auditor's perspective, Has it been looked at?
Oh, no. I mean, we totally understand. Like, people make mistakes. The more eyes, the better. You know, even the most looked at crypto code in the world has had mistakes, right?
Yes.
Like, you can't forget, like, Heartbleed or something. So, you know, no one is going to get offended at having more eyes on code.
Yeah. I'm not so worried about mistakes. I mean, mistakes can be found maybe more easily. I don't know. This is not my I'm not an expert in cryptography. I know cryptography, but I'm not a cryptographer myself. And so I'm more, quote, worried about, are there any backdoors that nobody has seen that's been coded like 3 years ago? I don't know.
Oh, no, nobody's seen our backdoors. We've hidden them very well.
So maybe it's a really naive from me to ask this, but this is what, for me, an auditor would be able to find out, I hope, I think. So that's the intent of my questions, basically.
Well, I mean, I think the backdoor question is probably like easier to answer, right? I mean, we're implementing essentially, you know, well, not standardized cryptography, but pretty standard schemes from papers. And all of the parameters are generally sampled on the fly, right? So the only way for me to sort of backdoor something is if you use my parameter set, right? I don't know if this makes sense, right?
Okay.
But sort of if you use like, say, like an example, do you remember the dual EC PRG debacle?
Nope. Sorry.
So this, there was a lot of speculation that the NSA had backdoored a pseudorandom generator. And why?
Okay.
Because it was given to people with two fixed group generators. And if you knew the discrete log between the generators, you would break the security of the protocol, right?
Okay.
And no one knew how these generators were sampled, right? So it's entirely feasible that someone could have sampled them, right? By taking a random generator and then, like, you know, picking the other one in a way that they knew the discrete log, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this sort of was a scheme with the parameters fixed, right? Now, to my knowledge, there's not a single primitive in URSA that comes with these sort of parameters fixed, at least in a way that there are sort of multiple parameters where sort of they're prefixed for you, and you don't know how they were generated. When we do generate parameters, we try to do it, you know, in a transparent way. So like one of the famous ways to generate group elements is to take like a hash of like Shakespeare or something, right? And then you're explaining your randomness and sort of how you sampled those parameters. So the idea is if I sampled my elements by hashing Shakespeare, then like I can't know the discrete log unless I've broken the collision resistance of the hash function.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes sense to you or not, but
yeah, well, it's not, I'm not knowledgeable enough in cryptography to really understand what you just said. Sorry about that.
No, totally fine. Totally understandable.
But so what I'm hearing basically is that if we want, we being either the government of Quebec or the financial institution that I work for, if we want more certainty about what's been done, we should probably contract an external partner and pay for it to audit the entire stack. Is that it?
Yeah, if you only care about backdoors, like did the developers backdoor the code, then that should be pretty simple and easy to verify that it is not the case, right?
Okay.
If you want like a thorough audit, like, you know, did the developers mess up somehow, right? Like
or follow good practices or
yeah, know, that but, kind but of follow good practices is also easy, right? Like, I mean, it's like anybody is going to be able to tell you that like, we follow good practices. I mean, that's
okay.
The difficulty is like, you know, did we make a mistake somewhere, right? That could cause a security issue, right? And if we did, sort of how easy, you know, is it to find, right? I mean, again, security bugs are everywhere. It's, you know, it's a matter of thorough review, and even like the best people make mistakes.
Yes.
So I think that's what you'd be, I mean, at least to me, that's what an interesting review would be looking for, is sort of like, you know, can we find any potential mistakes the developers made?
Yes. Okay.
And then like, you know, you can say, yeah, I mean, that's basically it.
Like, I think the danger comes from believing too much into the audit. So I've participated in about 10 audits, and let me give you an example. So I was doing an audit for a big finance firm where we were auditing some crypto code that we had just implemented. Okay. It went through two rounds of auditors where they paid $60,000 to each auditor a piece.
Okay.
And both sets of auditors missed a gaping bug in the code that totally could have caused a security issue.
Okay.
And I didn't write the code, but I came in after and I was looking through the code and I said, why are they doing this? Like it was a pretty obvious bug. Like, they were trying, they like had implemented their own ECDSA algorithm heart, and they were using, instead of doing like like with SHA-2, you know, how it's vulnerable to length extension attacks, they were like just prepending the key, among other things, like just kind of little simple stuff like that, right? That an auditor in my mind should have caught, but they didn't. And I was like, why in the world would it two sets of auditors who do this full time, this is their sole job to look for this stuff, miss this? So my concern is people see the audit and they think, oh, it's been gold stamped, here we go. Right? In my mind, everybody should always do their own due diligence before they use something, regardless of who's audited it. So if you're worried about backdoors, like Hart said, that's an easy check. Yeah, have someone you trust look for those. And if they can't find anything, then great. That's the great thing about open source, is anybody can just go look at it. There's no restrictions. And if you want them to submit what they find, great. And if they find anything, we fix it. And my concern is, like, whenever I go through audits, I'm like, if they find anything, crap, this is going to be damaging, right? But at the same time, if they don't find anything, I'm always like, well, was the auditor really doing their job? So it's
kind of catching too, right?
So that's always been my concern with audits. And having been through many of them, that's always the outcome that I see. Is that there's they either find a ton of things and you're like grateful that they found them, but then it makes you question, well, did the developers just screw up? Or if they don't find anything, you're like, well, did the auditor do his job, or is the developer just that good? You know, like, so there's two different ways to read it. I always just tell people, like, before you use anything, do your own due diligence until you're satisfied with it. So when people say, is it safe? Well, it depends. What is safe to you? Is safe mean no backdoors? Okay, great. To me, safe is the crypto code working according to the math that it was based on?
Yes.
Is it clearing secrets from memory? Is it doing best practices to avoid side channel attacks? Trying to do constant time? Those are the things that I personally look for in an implementation. Mm-hmm. And lately, what about, you know, CPU usage? What about code size? Those are things that I look for, but that's not what appeals to everyone.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, I've had, I guess, even a different experience than that, where I was on one of these big audits for Ethereum, and they actually did it differently. They didn't hire a firm. They just rounded up as many cryptographers as they possibly could and got them to sort of, to look sort of for a, for bugs. So, you know, this, and then people actually found a bug. You know, so that was kind of neat, and it was exactly what you'd expect, where, you know, some you know, very good cryptographers had tried to make a shortcut. They tried to make an optimization and it compromised security. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, is sort of exactly the, you know, exactly what you'd expect.
Okay.
But yeah, so I guess, as discussed on the email list, if you like actually want like a thorough, you know, yes, review, the best bet is to probably find some cryptographers you can pay to review it for you.
And so you collectively don't see any benefit in going with a formal certification like FIPS, or maybe maybe there are others that I don't even know about.
Here's why
you can't get FIPS certified. Like FIPS is like a glacially slow process.
Okay.
Go ahead, Mike.
Well, yeah. So here's the biggest problem with going with FIPS. FIPS has an approved set of algorithms that they've already approved. And if you're using crypto that's not on that list, you can't get FIPS certification.
Oh, I see.
Right. And practically everything in URSA is not on that list. So the first example is we use a lot of pairing-based crypto, and not a single pairing-based algorithm is approved by FIPS. The second is pairing-based curves, which is an even lower level primitive. None of those are approved by FIPS either. So until that happens, URSA could never be FIPS compliant. You'd have to basically say, I'm not going to use any of that. And then you're just left with a few algorithms for signing and verifying, and that's about it. And that's not very helpful. The whole point of URSA is to get the ZKP stuff, and no ZKP algorithm that I'm aware of is FIPS approved.
Yeah, I don't think
they are FIPS approved or not.
No,
not.
And it's not like this is unique. Like no one is using FIPS ZKPs or NIST certified ZKPs because there aren't any yet, right? All of these certification agencies haven't tackled sort of zero knowledge primitives yet.
I see.
And it's not that they're not aware. Like, you know, NIST has quite good cryptography team these days. And they are, you know, fully aware of all of this stuff, but sort of getting something through NIST is like super slow. I mean, I think NIST started.
And expensive.
Yeah. I mean, when did NIST start the post-quantum challenge? It was like 2014, maybe.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's been going for quite some time.
So it's like a 7-year thing. And now with like post-quantum worries, it's like, well, do we want to standardize a non-post-quantum ZKP? You know, we now have Lattice ZKPs, although they're like horrendously inefficient.
Okay.
Do we want to wait for those to get better? Maybe they'll get better. Maybe they won't. It's complicated. So, I mean, I guess from their perspective, the decision-making is not straightforward. But yeah, so any kind of certifications like that are probably off the table unless you want to sort of delay everything 10 years.
Okay. I did not quite understand the very close link between NIST approved algorithms and FIPS.
It's just an example of standardization processes, right?
Yeah. Okay.
In particular, government standardization processes, they tend to be very slow and conservative.
Okay.
That's just all. I'm just, yeah.
Does Canada have anything like that?
Um,
I know other countries do. Like, I know, like, for example, I've worked with New Zealand and Australia governments, and they have something equivalent to NIST. I can't remember the name of it, but they basically will say, well, if you're on NIST, then we know it's okay for the most part.
Yeah, Dan, to my... Sorry, go ahead, Mike. I thought you were done.
Oh, I was going to say, like, in EU, they have some other algorithms that are approved for them that are not on NIST's list, like the Camella encryption algorithm, right? It's approved for EU, but it's not approved in the US. So there are some differences, but for the most part, they're pretty compatible.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly these agencies just, at least the Western ones, defer to NIST or work with NIST. Like, if you look at who submits to the NIST competition, it's actually mostly Europeans.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, I mean, it was a bunch. Everybody knows AES, right? But AES was invented by, you know, it's classic NIST standardization winner, invented by Europeans. I think all the Shahs were too.
It's always the Belgians that win. So
no, the Icelander is the Scandinavians that won the one AES.
Oh, who's the one that won was it Shaw 3?
Yeah, those the Belgians. It's usually the Belgians.
Yeah.
It's because there are a couple of universities in Belgium that have like probably the best sort of like block cipher symmetric key researchers in the world. Like if you want, ironically, like if you want to do like theoretical cryptography, the US and Israel are probably best. But if you want to do like block cipher design, then like Belgium and Central Europe are where a lot of those researchers are.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry for the...
So if we forget about FIPS, are there any other standards or audits that you think are worthwhile?
Yeah, again, just getting, so there aren't any standards covering this. So like, that's one of the reasons we have this is like, in fact, one of the primary reasons why we started URSA was because there weren't standards for this, right? There aren't standard implementations for these protocols. So standards are sort of out of the question.
Okay.
As far as auditing goes, we consider the best bet to be just getting knowledgeable cryptographers to look at the code.
Okay.
Sort of my, like, sort of my experience is that the auditing firms don't have as much knowledge about fancy cryptography, like pairings-based stuff.
Not usually. You have to point them to the paper, and half the time I had to write the pseudocode for them.
Yeah, so...
exactly my point. So you're paying this, you know, $60,000 to a firm to audit something that they don't even understand.
So, I mean, there are probably exceptions, but in general, that's sort of my experience as well. That these are like old school security auditors, and like once you start throwing pairings-based crypto at them, you know, it's not something they're used to.
So the challenge is how and where do we find good cryptographers that are not already on the URSA team?
Well, I mean, we're very small, and there's a large world of cryptographers. So, I mean, Mike can point you to some people, I mean, that he's worked with before. It's just a matter of asking people, I guess. I mean, from a...
It depends on the guarantees you're looking for. If you're looking to say, yes, this is a correct implementation, I usually will go to the like authors, and most of the authors are more than happy to do a pretty thorough audit for pretty low cost, because they're just excited to see that someone implemented their protocol or their algorithm. Like that happened with Anna Lasinskaya. She audited the CL signature, and same with Jan Kamesh, the two inventors of the signature. They both looked at it. Anna said, I can't see any security bugs with this implementation. And when Jan looked at it, the only thing he said is, I'd recommend you just increase the key size, but otherwise it looks good. That was what he said. So like BBS Plus has, you know, many, many people have looked at it and improved it. So it's not just the three original authors anymore. Then there's Poncheval Sanders signature. Those two authors are probably out there and willing to look at it. When I've implemented some cryptographic accumulators, I pointed the source code to the authors of the paper and they were delighted to point to it. In fact, they did a thorough audit and said, great, that looks good. Do you mind if we reference this in another publication? So
that's good.
That's usually a good place to start. So if, that's if you're looking for cryptographic guarantees. If you're looking for other things, then that's where the big firms kind of step in.
Yeah, I was going to say the grad students of the authors of the paper are usually the way to go. But yeah, I guess that's in pretty good accordance with Mike. All right. I mean, I guess the thing is for Ursa, though, there isn't a lot of other stuff. You know, so it's, if it's just, if you're just sort of auditing a, like a pure signature scheme, you know, yeah, I'd actually be, I don't know what like a big firm would charge for that. It's not a lot of code necessarily. And I guess if you're doing
they usually charge by based on complexity of the algorithms they're auditing and the lines of code.
Yeah. And I just don't know what the cost metric for like a pairings-based signature scheme would be.
I just did one where all they audited was BLS signatures. They didn't even audit the BLS curve code, just the signature part, and it was $30,000.
Man, I should really get in this business, huh?
Not, I'm telling you, Hart.
I mean, how long did they spend on it?
3 weeks.
How many lines of code is in that?
I can tell you here in a minute because I still have the report.
So no, I'm just curious.
Talk about something else while I'm looking it up, will you?
Yeah.
Let's talk about my new business for auditing auditors.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So they started August 10th and finished delivering the report August 31st. And I'm trying to see how many lines of code. It was about 15,000 lines of code.
Okay. So at least that was...
It's about $2 a line, more or less.
How did someone write a... What was in this implementation that took it 15,000 lines?
I wrote it, Hart.
Like... What, it's in Go. What was in it?
It's written in Go. Oh. So there's no generics. So basically the only thing you can do is copy and paste.
Okay.
There's a lot of code duplication. And then there's what I call what Go calls marshalling, or you can call it serialization in Rust, where you're converting to and from, you know, some serialization format.
Yeah, like this would be like 1,000 lines in Rust though, probably, right?
Yeah. I wrote one in. Yeah, it's pretty small.
That's what I was. What I was like.
Like a third of the lines. So,
okay, so maybe 1,000 is a low underestimate. Is an underestimate, but.
Yeah. So I mean, here's what they looked for. They looked for like what's the hash curve parameters. You know, is there bias in the when you do hash mod something? They checked for zero length message. You know, does it handle zero length messages? Is the HKDF algorithm implemented properly? See, that's the other problem is I had to implement HKDF.
Okay.
Because at the time I wrote it, there was no Go library for it.
That makes more sense.
I think there is now, but at the time I wrote it, there wasn't.
Yeah, no, if you had to implement all of this extra stuff, it makes sense why it was
this, they didn't audit any of the BLS curve stuff, just the signature. And that's how expensive it was.
Yeah.
They, They would have doubled their price if they wanted to audit the BLS Curve library. Hmm. But again, what were we going to look for? Oh, is there side channels? Well, this is Go, so probably, right? There's no memory management, that manual memory management that you can do. So you're
are there timing and memory attacks? Probably. Oh, yeah, this is
Go, right? The only thing they cared about was, is the signature implemented correctly? And then at the end of the report, since I can't give it to you or show it to you because it's confidential, but I can read this part of it. Like, it just says, you know, we audited the library for all this stuff by these two doctors who are cryptography experts and principal engineers. We checked for compliance with existing standards to identify potential security and interoperability issues and improvement recommendations to look for, you know, vulnerabilities and other remediations that might be, you know, and overall, yeah, I mean, here's what they said overall. The library we audited is the client's implementation of the BLS signature with good properties and a signature. The resulting, you know, in general, we found the implementation to be of high standard, and we believe that all the identified vulnerabilities can be easily addressed, which, just so you know, there was 9 lows and 5 informational vulnerabilities. And lows are like, I wouldn't even consider a vulnerability, so... We did not find any evidence of any hidden backdoor or malicious intent in the code. That's pretty much what they said at the end. So that's what you get from a firm.
I mean, I guess a firm is just like, it's reassuring to users, I guess.
Yeah. But so I said, it depends on what you want to look for.
Yeah.
So if you want the non-cryptographic correctness, hire a firm.
Yeah, but I mean,
let's hire a cryptographer.
Yeah, that's a totally reasonable.
You're going to pay about the same either way.
All right. Well, thank you very much for all of that. I think I've taken some notes while you were all talking. I appreciate the feedback and the enlightenment for me. So I'll go back and circle that around internally and see what they say and see how they feel about it. And
And feel free to ask if you follow up if you have more questions or anything like that.
Yes,
thank if you know any other cryptographers, you should probably ask them as well.
Yep.
You know, you can get another opinion, and maybe you'll even convince them to review your code. Yeah, I mean, Andreas is commenting, it depends on the liability assumed in the due diligence. My understanding is these things have very little liability. Mike has probably more experience with this than I do.
With what, the liability?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You have to do your due diligence. So but
these firms are not like assuming any liability.
That's correct. So when like I said, for the finance firm, right? Finances, billions of dollars at risk, right? They hired me and a bunch of other cryptographers. I don't count myself as a cryptographer. I'm more of an applied person, but you know, to look at this. So we inspected every line of code to look to make sure there was no problems. BLS signature was just one thing. There was other stuff, but we inspected every single line that someone else wrote, and then they had the other audit firms audit some other stuff, you know? So, I mean, we didn't go off of any existing reports about what we were using. So that was the due diligence, so that, you know, from a liability perspective, we could say we did our best to make sure that there was no problems with this library that we could see.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to go full on ham, then you would do both the firm and actual cryptographers.
Yes.
And that way, sort of like you would make everyone happy.
Yeah. Understood. Makes sense.
But that's also going to cost more. So,
yeah.
Yeah. As you can see, we are sort of, we're clearly biased towards the cryptographers here.
Yes.
But, you know,
and they understand why, so it makes sense to me. So I'll just see what they want to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be like a, I guess it's not personal, but you know what I mean. If I say a personal decision,
Yes, sort of
what you want, and like a lot of it is, you know, what can you tell users or customers or whatever. So, if having a
your board of directors,
yeah, you're right. Yeah, if having a firm makes people more comfortable, then, you know, it might be worth it in some cases, right?
Well, it has all to do, I guess, with risks, liability, and what they want, what's their appetite, what they want to take on with or without an audit being from a firm or from a bunch of cryptographers. So I'll just relay back the message and see what they say.
Yeah, most firms, like big firms, though, they usually will want, like, say, a CISO or a, the CISP or a CISA, C-I-S-A, was a certified information security auditor. Like, if they'll stamp it, then that's usually good enough for them. But most of those people, unfortunately, don't have the background to audit it anyway.
Yeah, that's the problem. All right. Thank you very much.
Yep. Feel free to follow up if you have any more questions or comments. Or
yes, thank you.
If you want us to talk to anybody.
Well, this is probably where I'll probably be coming back to you guys once I have a better understanding of which way they want to go. And it might probably take, it will probably take a couple of weeks. Because there's the financial institution and there's the entire ecosystem of company that we're trying to convince to move over to this tech stack along with the government. And so probably none of them are even aware that there might be a problem. So I will let them know what I've found through this those discussions with you guys and through the mailing list as well, which was helpful to me.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks a lot. And thanks for coming to the meeting.
Thank you.
Une fois bienvenue.
Yeah, thanks again.
Dan, you're always a sucker for the different language greeting.
It's fun for me.
The backstory is I've probably heard Dan greet people in like 15 different languages at this point. So
maybe fewer than that. But
maybe that's a slight exaggeration, but it's certainly more than five.
Could be.
Japanese, Mandarin, Portuguese, I think.
You can do a little Portuguese.
Probably either Dutch or German in English. So we're already at five, and I'm probably missing. We just did French.
Finnish, Russian. Yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure I've heard you speak Finnish.
Oh, well, we'll have to come up with an excuse for that.
Yeah. Anyway, I guess, Mike, in the time that's left, should we go over, I put you next on the agenda. Do you want to go over Oberon or do you want to talk about the revocable hive?
I can talk about Oberon. I mean, we've kind of talked about it before. And the biggest thing I get from question I get from people is why Oberon, right? I did publish it as a crate. I don't care if it's in URSA or not, but it might be something that we can use in URSA.
Sir, did you send a note about Oberon earlier? I didn't read it.
To everyone but you, Dan, you know.
Jeez, Mike, you really hurt my feelings.
Well, I tried my best. The whole point of Oberon was two reasons. One was to replace authentication with a simple like multi-factor system, and two, authorization, because you can embed a whole bunch of, say, permissions into this thing and it doesn't increase the token size. So Oberon is basically like BLS and Punchable Sanders kind of mixed together. I mean, here's how the cryptography is, but here's the Rust code. It works on no standard, which means you can run it in an embedded environment because there's no allocator. It also does compile the WASM. Here's just examples, but the point of it is there is a service you want to use, whether it's an API endpoint or maybe you want to log in. And that service, when you register, gives you a token. And let me break. I presented this at IAW, so I don't know if it would be helpful for me to show the slides.
Can you at least email them out?
Yeah.
Can you send them to the URSA list?
Hey, what is going on? Google is not working. Sweet. No. Google's down, everybody. So let's see. I get. Where did it go? No, not docs. What is it? Is it slides?
You should also write this up and submit it to a security conference, but
I'm working on it. I've written about 10 pages on it so far.
Are you like writing in the proper format?
Heart always LaTeX.
Well, no, but like a proper like paper
intro related
like,
work.
Yeah, like a proper like Usenix paper format.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's my goal.
Yeah.
This is actually is 96. So here's how it works. So the server only has to store a single public key, and you can separate the token issuing authority from the verifier, because of, you know, this is a token, so you're signing something, and then that person can now take it and use it. So it's kind of a similar vein of verifiable credentials, but this is a very simple token. Here I just show that you could do this in a threshold way, but you don't have to. But because this is a BLS signature, right? It's a single round threshold signature, or as Hart says, the only true threshold scheme, and you get this token. And what you're signing is any piece of information that you want to be able to present again. So like in my case, I just said the ID, which could just be a random identifier, but it could be your email. It could be an email and a timestamp, and maybe the timestamp includes when it expires. You know, throw whatever you want in there. It doesn't matter. Maybe you want all of the permissions for your system, so you can say can read, can write, can access database, whatever. Throw in all these extra attributes that you want for authorization. And then you get this token. Well, then the device can apply like a PIN number or an HSM key to blind the token. So the token is never stored in plain text. And you might say, why would you do that versus encryption? You can still use encryption, but here's where I like it. And I'll get to that in a minute. But the point is now, if I ever go to use this token, I have to know this secondary or tertiary factors, right? However many factors I want to add to it. And that's the thing that you don't get with just plain encryption or pub key authentication, is you're now relying on like whatever the system has to offer or some other thing. Whereas this can be practically anything that you want to tack on there. So that's what the blue part is. It's this PIN number or an HSM. It can even change across devices, but you have the same token. And so then you store this blinded token. And then when you go to use it, you take the blinded token, you take, you prompt for whatever the PIN is or the HSM key or whatever you want to apply the blinding factors. And the cool thing is you never have to unblind the token per se. So they never get the original in plain text. You can create the ZKP in such a way that it doesn't ever put the token in plain text. So it always is bound to the secondary factor on the system you're on. Now, if you want to, say, export it to another device, of course, you're going to have to unblind it completely to send it over, but that's usually okay. So in this case, this is like I'm going to log into a web server, right? So, hey, I'm going to log in. Okay, here's a nonce, and then you do your proof, and you're in. That's like the three-way. Now, let's say you're doing like an API endpoint where you don't want to do the three-way handshake, right? So you can use a value that's nothing up my sleeve, and like a timestamp or say the latest Bitcoin hash instead of the nonce. And you can still generate the proof, and then it's a one-way thing. The server just has to be a little more careful about how they accept the proof. But the proof is a ZKP, so the token itself is never presented to the server. The server just gets a zero-knowledge proof of a valid token. So they do see the ID, and that's fine. So this is what the server sees, right? They get the nonce or the timestamp, the proof, and the ID. And they just check whether it's valid or not using the public key. And this proof changes every time because that's what zero knowledge proofs are supposed to do, so that if an attacker tries to replay, they don't get it. Right? They don't get the token ever. It's never presented the same. So there's, as long as the proof is random at each time, which it should be, then this is a one-time proof, and they never get the token, and they can't replay it either, which is really cool. So they learn nothing, and this is the only primitives that I'm using. So I'm using BLS, but I'm using the punchable sender ZKP to do this. So it's presenting a signature proof of knowledge is what it's doing. But in my case, because I'm not hiding the attribute, because I'm disclosing it in this case, like with the ID, you don't have to do any Schnorr proofs or proof of committed values. Because you just eliminate all of that in this case. Because usually when you're logging into a system, the service needs to know something about who you are, right? What's your account number? I'm not going to tell you. Well, then I can't give you your balance, right? That doesn't work. Or give me my emails. You don't need to know my email address. Well, yes, I do, because I need to know which ones are yours, right? That's generally how services work today. So with Oberon, like, this is the device stores this blinded token, right? The original was the yellow one. And then if an attacker does a snapshot of your token, right, the only thing he still has to try and guess your secondary factor. So if it's a four-digit PIN, that's not going to take him very long to try it out. If you encrypted the token, now he's got to guess the key. Or if you bound the secondary factor to an HSM key, he's not going to get very far, or it's going to take him a very, 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 very long time to do this. And you could increase the PIN number to say 8 digits, and now it takes him even longer, or 10 digits, but whatever you want to do, right? It's completely up to you. That's why I had this added this flexibility. So the MFA can change per device, right? You have the same token on multiple devices. So on a phone or a laptop, apply different secondary factors. It's really hard to do this with pub key authentication. So that's what this offers. And then I just have a single public key, so anybody can verify these tokens. I don't have to pass around a key per device, right? That's one of the biggest problems with pub key authentication, is it's usually one-to-one. In this case, it's one-to-many. So the only thing you really need is you pick a pairing friendly curve, generate 3 BLS keys, and give the public key to the server, and the private key stays with the signing authority, wherever that is. So you can lock it down. And this is very similar to how PKI servers work today. They have some signing service that's behind a very guarded firewall, among other things. And then the public key is somewhere else, which is fine, because if an attacker gets the public key, what's he gonna do? He's just gonna be able to verify tokens. Right. So then I just kind of walk through how the crypto works. It's basically just this. So it's very similar to BLS and punchable senders. So that's how you get your token. And then when you want to say blind it, add a blinding factor, I just hash to a point and then subtract it out of the signature. It's that simple. So if you want, I'm saying you only have to store this, but if you wanted, you could store all of these to avoid computations, but you don't have to. But that's how it is. So keeps it simple. Anyway, and then so, just presenting. So, and I'm saying when I compute this way, instead of doing it this way, notice then this never gets unblinded in memory. It stays blinded, but then the proof is computed this way. So you never have a plain text token anymore by doing it this way. At a slight cost of an extra scalar multiplication.
So resisting the urge to message Dave Husby.
Yeah, he keeps chatting me, can you tell?
Yeah. I'm tempted to be like, you're wrong about the 10%, Dave. And you'll just have no idea. But do you have performance numbers for this? I mean, I can kind of guess.
It's very fast, like 2 milliseconds to generate a proof. Signing is even faster, like microseconds.
I mean, I would guess the... So if you're wanting to sell this at like a computer security conference, for instance, you might want to compare it to legacy systems in terms of performance.
That's a bad idea. I'll add
and
that.
this would be like not just one time, but scaling, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So sort of overall throughput and scaling. And that might be a very interesting comparison.
In my paper, I'm comparing this to like, you know, here's all the other attacks that you have to consider, like forgot password, email hack, SIM clone attack,
well, but
snapshots, key compromise impersonation, like a lot of things that Oberon mitigates or helps with. And then performance, yeah, I can add that too.
So I would add like performance at scale, basically, right? Because your model is like running a server for this, right? How does it compare to like the traditional, like, you know, server, like, right? Like no one cares about, like if you're just doing one authentication, right? I mean, you know, who cares? But it's the scaling, right? But a huge advantage is you don't have to store anything, so.
Well, you store small amounts of data. And right. So, like I said, if you're deploying a fleet of things, then you can just give people a single public key, because that doesn't hard anything, and then they can get their own token.
Right.
One thing I didn't show was a way to use this token to do a key exchange instead of SSL.
Well, I mean, look, if you already have a signature interface in place, like you can do key exchange. Or if at least, sorry, it depends on the signature, but yes, if you already have a pairing-based signature, right?
Right. So,
that's.
I mean, the point is I have a token, you have a token, I know your ID, you know my ID, therefore we can just start talking to each other over an encrypted channel, even though we've never talked to each other before.
Right, it's the implicit IB.
Yep, yeah, that's the IB. So when you're talking to like hundreds of devices, this is nice because now I don't have to set up pub key authentication for each one individually. I just hand out a token. If they have a token, they can now even start talking to each other and away they go, right?
So how are you handling token generation?
So typically I have three roles in how this system works. The first is there's an enroller, which is like say me. Then there's the enrollee, which is like, say, a device that I control or I'm onboarding, right? So maybe it's a robot, maybe it's some other IoT device, right? Sensors,
sure.
Whatever. So it's usually directly in my control anyway. And then there's some service that I'm going to have them report to. So maybe it's a satellite, maybe it's, you know, a server somewhere.
And what are the properties you need out of the service?
Usually they're reporting to the service and it needs to be over an encrypted channel.
Right. But do you need like the service to be honest or something?
Yes. The service has to be honest.
Okay. like the interesting question is, what if the service is compromised, or can you distribute the service?
You can distribute the service.
Okay. That might be something to bring up in your paper.
But the point of them being able to talk to each other is sometimes if the, let's say the service goes down, so this is a resiliency problem.
Yeah, no, totally. I understand. You don't, you only need the service for setup, right? It's just like IBE, right? In an IBE scheme, you only need,
I see what you're saying. Yeah. So the service can be distributed. That's why I chose BLS and tried to get this to work, right? Because then I can do threshold setup and boom.
I would emphasize that in your protocol, because you're going through all these extra steps in security. Like, it makes no sense not to use threshold setup, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Like if you were doing this practically, like even if you were a single company setting this up, right, you'd probably want to use some kind of threshold setup to avoid like potential issues if like your server got compromised.
Yes. Well, the other reason I chose Pawn-Shovel Sanders is Pawn-Shovel Sanders also supports what's called a sequential aggregation signature, mm-hmm. where each, remember I said there's three BLS keys. So even if I don't threshold the BLS keys, I can distribute one BLS key per server and they just aggregate, and then you can still just aggregate to a single signature.
Right. Yeah.
So that's what's really nice about it is Pick your model that works for you. There's two different ways to do it. If you don't want to do complex threshold signing, fine, just do this. Just distribute the three BLS keys to three different servers, have each one do a different operation, and then send the results to the single person or wherever it's going, and then they just aggregate it, and you're done.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't view threshold signatures as exceptionally complicated, but...
No, they're not. It's distributed key gen that usually gets people... So
yeah, that's true. All right. So, well, it looks like we're out of time and people are leaving. But yeah, thanks a lot for going over this, Mike. And share your slides if you can.
Yeah. Okay.
If you don't mind like sending them out to the list.
They're public. I can send them to the list.
Yeah, just send the link or the and yeah, you should definitely submit this to a security conference.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, everybody.
All right. Thanks.
And have a great rest of your week.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Give Fuseby some grief for me, Mike.